strict orders that the lecturers today have to finish bang on time, so I'm not going to be the weak link. So today I want to talk about gravitational perturbation theory. So that's taking a background in gravity and looking at linearized fluctuations around the background. So in general relativity in particular, perturbation theory is extremely useful because we have such a limited set of exact solutions. So it's quite hard to find exact solutions because GR is so nonlinear. And therefore, it's often easier to look at a physical problem, look at the broad features, try and simplify to the sort of essentials of a particular situation. So if you're looking at a star, it would be spherical symmetry. Simplest thing you can do first is make it completely static and vacuum. In cosmology, we approximate our universe as being exactly homogeneous and isotropic and find the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solutions. And of course, we know that the real gravitating situation is much messier. There's, for example, with stars, there's matter around, there's rotation. In the universe, we're definitely not in an isotropic universe because we exist. We've got galaxies. But it's much easier to take the broad background, an exact background that's very symmetric, find an exact solution, and then look at fluctuations around that solution and solve for those perturbations. So presumably, you'll see, those of you doing the cosmology course will be seeing that in the sense that cosmological perturbation theory is essentially where it's all at in terms of talking about our universe. So I want to do this, but do it again from just a more of a pure GR perspective, not in terms of a given application, and to try and just highlight, well, first of all, to derive what the gravitational perturbation equation actually is, but then to sort of discuss some of the issues, some of the pitfalls that you might find when you're actually trying to solve for these equations. Gosh, these breakfasts are getting more and more exotic as we come. What's this one? It's cereal. It's just as well I've eaten, otherwise I would probably be gasping by the end of this lecture. So, what are the bullet points here? Okay, so that sums up what I was saying, more or less. So the idea is that we are taking our metric, our background geometry, and we're writing it. And sorry, but H also traditionally gets used for this perturbation. We're writing it as some known exact solution, or typically we write this as a known, usually a known exact solution. And H is some small perturbation. So that's what we do. That's what we always do when we do perturbation theory. So let's have a look at what happens to our Einstein equations when we expand around some known solution. So the first thing we do is we expand in H. So what we're doing is if we're looking, minus, not put gamma, it's not delta gamma at the moment. So we are, if we think about our connection components, the Christoffel symbols, what we're doing is we're putting in our metric. So this is just literally writing down. I've just put dot, 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 because I don't want to write everything out. And if we want to look at what the change in the connection is, we can use this normal coordinate argument. So remember, in normal coordinates, we're assuming that we're taking a local flat frame. We're taking coordinates in which the connection vanishes locally. And so we only, in this expression, the only thing we're keeping are derivatives of H, because the term in square brackets is now linear in H. We ignore that term there. And so we would get, in normal coordinates, that would be our normal coordinate expression. And then because we're in normal coordinates, the background connection components vanish. So these partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivatives. So I can promote the commas to semicolons. And then I've got a covariant expression. And so this now gives me, because the connection vanishes in normal coordinates, this tells me that delta gamma ABC in normal coordinates is an expression involving covariant derivatives of the perturbation, but that is now a completely covariant expression. Difference of connections is also a tensor. So I can drop this normal coordinate suffix there and say this is the variation in the connection.
Could you say again why
it's delta gamma?
Yes.
Because in normal coordinates, gamma vanishes. So this is the connection in normal coordinates, but I'm basically subtracting off zero from each side, right? Because in normal coordinates, gamma zero vanishes. So that's what I want, is a completely covariant expression, tensor equals tensor.
So when you think about coordinates, you mean G0, ABC?
Yes, that's what I meant. So, yeah, absolutely. Thank you. This gives me a variation of a connection, and then if I want a variation of my Ricci tensor, so if you remember, we used this when we were looking at deriving a variational principle very first time. And so all I have to do is input my expression for delta gamma to get the variation of the Ricci. So in this case, if I look here,
okay.
in the variation, you mean which AV?
Yes, I do, don't I? Thank you. It's going to be one of those days. Keep a beady eye on me, okay? I can see I'm going to miss. Right, so I've just inputted the expression for delta gamma. So here we've got that the variation of the Ricci tensor is given in terms of second derivatives of H. Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's sort of half, they come from the fact that you had the half in.
I should have had the half. It's, okay, keep going, come on. You've got to keep me on, got to keep me honest here. I'm obviously having, let me put a 2 there. I'm not sure I'm firing on all cylinders today, so. It's because of the half in the expression for the Christoffels, which should have been there in the first place and wasn't, so. I obviously wasn't looking closely enough at what was written on the piece of paper. Right, so. If I look at these first two terms, I can see I've got a covariant derivative which is contracted with one of the indices of the H, but there's another covariant derivative in the way. So what I'd like to do is reverse the ordering of that differentiation so that this covariant derivative hits H directly, so that we have like a divergence term. So I want to swap the ordering of that differentiation, which I can do using the Riemann identity. So that's what I'm doing in this next line. But then, of course, I've obviously got to subtract off or add. The relevant Riemann terms. So all I've done there is simply use my Riemann identity on H to flip the order of differentiation. And then I do it on the second term, which is simply this first term with A and B swapped. So I'm just going to say it's the same term with A and B swapped. And then I keep these last two terms, which is a half box H and minus a half grad A grad B of the trace of H. So now you can see that this term is just a Ricci term, and this term here is obviously a Riemann term, but it's symmetric on A and B. So when I say I've taken plus A interchange B, this term is simply the same because H is symmetric. So what I end up with if I pull out a factor of minus a half, I've got the wave operator acting on H. If I reorder those indices a little bit, I've got a Riemann term, which is contracted with H. Then I've got a Ricci term, contracted with H and symmetrized. And then finally, I've got these covariant derivatives here.
Is it supposed to be CA or a minus sign?
No, I've swapped an ordering here. In this expression here, the H was contracted on the two adjacent indices, and now it's contracted on the second and fourth. So I've swapped an ordering here, and I've just rearranged the indices using the usual symmetries of the Riemann tensor. So I think you should just look at it, and because this is, I've simply swapped those two. So here it's on 2 and 3, and there it's on 2 and 4. So I get a relative minus sign.
Yeah, there is no minus sign.
So. So this H bar here is simply a combination. I've pulled together this term and the trace term there. So I'm just rewriting. I've sort of tried to pull everything together and rewrite it. So it's kind of, if you can't follow absolutely every step, just sort of may just mean you have to sort of stare at it a bit offline afterwards. So this whole expression here is the curved space generalization of the wave operator. So it's the appropriate wave operator for a spin 2 massless gravitational excitation. So it's called the Lichnerovich operator. And it's sort of, it's just the curved space wave equation. Okay, so that's derived just the bare expression for our perturbation, H. And now I want to start kind of thinking about issues or picking it apart a little bit. So if you look, there's four terms here. So this is the D'Alembertian, so we expect to see that, because that's what we would expect in some propagating field theory. We'd expect to see this wave operator sitting there. So that's sort of expected. Okay. This is the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor is something physical. It's telling us about tidal forces. So this is somehow telling us about how the background tidal forces are going to feed in to this perturbation. This is the Ricci tensor. So again, that's something physical. It's not tidal forces now, but it's related to the matter content. But again, it's geometrical. It's telling us something about the curvature of the manifold. The final term, it's also sort of second derivatives of H, but it's not so clear whether this has any physical relevance. So that's the first issue that I just want to address. How much of this equation is sort of real, is representing physics, some physical part of the problem, and how much of it is spurious? because we have, as we know in general relativity, we have a very large gauge group. We can do general coordinate transformations. So what impact do those gauge transformations have on this operator? So let's see. So in some sense, the fact that those Riemann and Ricci terms are there is simply sort of reflecting this non-linearity of gravity, the fact that that general relativity is this extremely non-linear sort of self-coupled theory. So in fact, it would have been a surprise if terms like that weren't there. But let's think about the last term. So it contains this divergence of this sort of slightly modified perturbation tensor. So locally, we can write a coordinate transformation infinitesimally as just taking the original set of coordinates and adding a small shift. So we move a little bit along a vector field, say. So this is the local infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So if we make a coordinate transformation, we're shifting our manifold a little bit by moving a little bit along the curves, the integral curves of Xi. So Xi is some vector field, and we can think of a coordinate transformation as just sort of shifting a little bit along a curve to which Xi is tangent. And so if we do that, we know locally, I'll put an epsilon there to indicate this is infinitesimal. Locally, we're simply using this, remember from the expression of the Lie derivative, that the Lie derivative was saying move a little bit along a vector field, look at the value of g there, and then subtract what you would get if you took g at your original point and kind of pushed it forward to that point there. So the Lie derivative is telling us how things change when you just shift a little bit along a vector field. So this or another way of writing the Lie derivative of G is as the symmetrized covariant derivative of Xi. Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay. So as you can see, doing a gauge transformation will shift what the components of the metric are, unless, of course, Xi is a killing vector. But a general one. So this is telling us that a gauge transformation induces a perturbation. So here I'm going to just drop the epsilon just for simplicity and just say I've absorbed it in psi. So psi here is meant to be sort of some small parameter. So I put perturbation obviously in inverted commas because this is not a physical perturbation. This is a gauge perturbation of the metric. And so if I look at what happens to this divergence here, then, oops, and then I've got to subtract. So the trace of H is just twice the divergence of psi. And therefore, when I take this overall divergence of h bar, I've got two terms that are derivatives of the vector psi, and then I've got a gradient of the divergence of psi. And so once again, I'm going to swap the ordering of differentiation here, because if I do that, then this term will cancel with that term. So here this is grad A grad B minus grad B grad A of psi. So what I've got there, which is again another wave equation of sorts, is something that is actually, if you were just in a vacuum, it would simply be that box of psi was equal to this this divergence of h bar. But what this tells me is that's actually a well-posed sort of differential equation, well-posed problem, and it tells me that if this divergence of h bar is not zero initially, I can then make a coordinate transformation. I can solve this wave equation for psi using whatever the div of h bar was as a source, and I can use that to make a coordinate transformation to get rid of the divergence of h bar. So in other words, that last term in the Lichnerowicz operator is a gauge term. It doesn't contain physical information. So we can choose to set that to zero. And this is called the Dodonda gauge. So that's a very common gauge that gets used in perturbation theory. Once you're in that gauge, all you're left with are pure geometric terms. You've got your wave operator and your curvature tensors. Another thing that you can do in vacuum you can also consistently choose a gauge in which the trace of the perturbation H vanishes, and hence the divergence of H itself vanishes. So this one here is called TTF for transverse trace free. Which is hopefully obvious which bit is which.
But then, if we are not in vacuum, we have an extra degree of freedom.
So I'm going to do a degree of freedom counting in a moment. So we have exactly the same numbers of degrees of freedom, whether or not of this propagating H, whether or not we're in vacuum. It's just a question of how simple you can make the algebra. So if you're in vacuum, so I think an easy way is actually almost the converse. The remaining, you can kind of show that, you know, doing what your remaining gauge freedom is, you can again set H equal to zero, but at that point you will need no Ricci term. So I think if you take the trace of this operator, and again in vacuum that would mean it had to be zero, then that's a completely consistent, keeping H equals zero is consistent with the equations of motion. If you have perturbation, if you're not in vacuum, you'll find that taking the trace of that equation will then not be consistent with keeping H equal to zero. So it's just kind of sort of seeing, you know, what's consistent with the setup that you actually have. So I'm just sort of trying to go through a sort of set of common gauges and saying, you know, what's the, you know, what are the advantages of each particular one. So the Dodonda one is always okay, but sometimes you can use transverse trace free. It sort of depends, I guess, on the matter content. But typically, if you have matter present and matter perturbations, typically transverse trace-free does not work. So another gauge that's common, well, so depending on the symmetries present, another useful gauge could be Gaussian normal. So this would be a useful gauge in a situation where you had a kind of foliation or planar symmetry, pseudo-planar symmetry, of your space-time, such as the case with domain walls. So when I talked about having a codimension one object, I defined my proper distance. I said I've defined a coordinate to be proper distance from the wall, and I said that my metric could be written as some sort of four-dimensional, this is when we're doing Randall Sundrum yesterday, some four-dimensional piece minus this proper distance. And so in this case, I could look at perturbations keeping this general form. In other words, only having perturbations sitting in this four-dimensional piece. So if I choose HZA equals zero, then this is a sort of Gaussian normal gauge. And what it means is you've chosen a normal, you've fixed a coordinate. This coordinate has a physical meaning. And once you've done that, that kind of is set, that is a gauge choice. So that's another possible gauge. If you're in that gauge, then of course you can't ignore that fourth term in the Lichnerowicz operator. So that's the downside. The upside is that a lot of the other terms vanish because you've got no HZA components. So it kind of, you use the gauge that works best for the problem at hand. Depends. So it really depends on the setup that you're dealing with. Most commonly, in most situations, the Donda gauge gets used. But again, I'm not even starting on this, on the sort of harmonic gauge of that the numerical relativists use. So I think it really depends what you're doing. And if you're doing things not, you know, by hand, you're wanting to do stuff analytically, typically the primary motivator is with your own self-interest is to make it as algebraically uncomplicated as possible, right? So usually that's de Donda or transverse trace free, because then you get rid of a lot of the terms in the equation. But if you're doing like the Randall-Sundrum model, you'd probably choose Gaussian normal because that's a gauge adapted to the physical problem. But again, in numerical relativity, they use a different gauge again, harmonic gauge, because that's much better catered to the integration. So it just you choose a gauge. It's completely total self-interest. You make the problem as easy as possible. So let me just do do a bit of counting here. If we are in the Donda gauge, so let's So let's just take E.G. de Donda. Then we fixed our gauge by setting the divergence of H bar to zero, but we could still have residual gauge freedom. In fact, we do, because we can make a coordinate transformation, and as long as our vector field obeys this generalized wave equation, then it's okay, because then we know that the divergence of H bar is equal to zero. So that's our residual gauge freedom. So let's do some counting. HAB is symmetric, so it has D into D plus 1 over 2 components. So this would be how many different independent functions we've got. Then we've got our gauge constraints. And I've got one free index there, so there's D of them. And finally, I've got still some residual gauge freedom. And in this case, I can choose chi such that it satisfies this wave equation. So there's going to be D solutions to that as well. So the total number of degrees of freedom is this original D into D plus 1 over 2 minus 2D. So the So these are the physical degrees of freedom for the fluctuations around the background. Yep.
Why do we subtract the residual degrees of freedom from the physical?
Because I want to get the physical degrees of freedom. So at this point, so I start off with D into D plus 1 over 2 components of H. But I have to satisfy, I've got to use these gauge constraints. So this gives me a D equations, which I can use to express some of these D of these components in terms of the rest. So that knocks me down to D into D minus 1 on 2. But I know I've still got gauge freedom, so not all of those remaining solutions are physical. And I know that I've got D degrees of gauge freedom left. So of those D into D minus 1 on 2 degrees of freedom, D of them are gauge. So that leaves me with D into D minus 3 on 2 that are physical. Yep.
A question. So why does this counting not work in D equals 2?
In D equals 2. Yeah. So it obviously works in D equals 3, so there's no propagating degrees of freedom. Probably because I've probably done some double counting. I'm going to have to come back to you on that, but it's probably because I've done some double counting in terms of thinking about how many degrees of freedom there are. Let me see if I can. I used to know that. I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I think it's because there's a double, it'll be that something has been double counted.
Are there gravitons in two dimensions?
No. So in two dimensions, your metrics sort of always conformally flat, and basically, you know, everything is sort of topological.
The perturbation series. Yeah.
So, that's a fun question. Oh, there's your tutorial question for tomorrow. No, so I'll go back to you on that one. Okay, so if D equals 4, we get 2 degrees of freedom, which we already knew, which was our sort of cross and plus polarized gravitational wave. So in five dimensions, we sort of make a quick leap up to 5 degrees of freedom. So you can sort of think of those as plus and cross polarizations in two of the planes, and then a sort of linear combination of a plus and a cross in the final plane. So this fits in with our exact gravitational wave that we derived last week, I think, sometime. And as I advertised, this is sort of a general counting, and it's whether or not you've got matter present. If you were in vacuum and you took a transverse trace free gauge, the way the counting would go would be slightly different, because you would be subtracting off more degrees of freedom by your gauge constraints, but then you would have fewer residual degrees of freedom, which then satisfied both transverse and trace-free conditions. So either way you cook it, it always turns out to be the same number of propagating degrees of freedom. So I'll just sort of use the last 5 minutes or so to talk about some other things, other issues you have to think of in perturbation theory, and using that black string instability as a sort of working example. So in the case of the black string instability, our background is Schwarzschild cross R. So our Ricci tensor vanishes, and we just have Riemann components, which we can calculate. And they only have non-zero values in the sort of Schwarzschild coordinate directions. And what we do, usually with perturbations, is that we decompose with respect to the symmetries of the background. So in this case, we have a d by dt, we've got a d by dz, we've got an SO3 symmetry. So we know that our general perturbations will be like Fourier modes in time and along the z direction, and there'll also be something like spherical harmonics in to do with the theta and phi directions. Moreover, because we've got this split between a four-dimensional space and an additional direction, we can think of our metric in terms of the way it behaves with respect to the four-dimensional space-time, the Schwarzschild space-time. So you, again, if you're doing cosmology, you've probably seen this type of decomposition. where you're projecting, if you like, the parts of your perturbation onto the four-dimensional diffeomorphism group. So you've got a scalar, H55. We did this with Kaluza-Klein theory, essentially. We've got a scalar, H55. We've got a vector, which is the cross terms. And then we've got our tensor perturbation, which is something that's living in the mu nu space. Now, if you look at the Lichnerowicz operator and look, these individual pieces sort of are transform independently, you can show that there is no instability in the scalar or vector modes. And so the instability has to be a tensor mode. So it's, I mean, of course, H is a tensor. This is just the sort of standard phrasing that you use when you're doing this. And so what you look for is an S-wave mode. So what are the possible issues? I was using this as an example, just sort of things that you have to think about when you're doing perturbation theory. Well, one of the things is sort of blindingly obvious, but I've not actually addressed it, which was right from the get-go, I wrote G was G naught plus H. And then we linearized an H. So that carries with it a notion of H being small. But you should know by now that big and small are not really very well-defined concepts in gravity in and of themselves. You've always really got to say, big or small with respect to what? So if you want to think about black hole perturbation theory, I mean, this is just a sort of very specific example of perturbations around a black hole. You have to be quite careful because, of course, you've got a singularity, the singularity being the event horizon. And so at the event horizon, parts of the metric are going to zero, parts are blowing up. How do you decide what big or small is? So typically, you have to, if in doubt, if it's not obvious, so you have to go to a non-singular coordinate system. So we're okay here because we know what that is. It's going to be crustal. Even then, in this particular example, it still wasn't entirely obvious because in your black hole space-time, the sort of R equals 2gm at finite t is actually a degenerate point. So you also have to think about initial data surfaces. So if you're doing perturbation theory for black holes, you actually have to take an initial data surface which ends on the future horizon. So these are just some things you have to sort of think about. So most applications don't have to worry about this. I'm just jotting down some things that sort of pitfalls, things you have to think about. So if you want to be using perturbation theory, you want to make sure that you have a complete set of solutions so that your differential operator is self-adjoint and so that you can say that the real physics, any physical situation can be expanded in the basis of solutions. So that's a sort of another little niggly thing. I'm just writing these down. They may or may not be relevant or useful at any particular point. So basically, you've got to think about your gauge, think about coordinate systems and making sure H is small, making sure that your problem is well posed and set up. And so in this particular case, you use your gauge constraints to find, to reduce the whole family of differential equations from the Lichnerowicz operator down to one, which you can then solve. So in this particular example, you find an HAB, which sends your horizon to some sort of squashed sausage, which has little little waves that run up and down the vent horizon. So I need to stop because we're under strict instructions to not run over today. But what I hope I've done is at least given you some indication of what sort of general curved space perturbation theory is like, some of the issues that you have to think about. It's probably not been entirely clear what some of these things mean. That's okay, that's fine. It's one of those situations where until you try something out and kind of trip up, you just don't, you know, you don't kind of know what things can go wrong. But hopefully I've planted a little seed of sort of different things that you have to think about so that if you ever need to solve a problem in perturbative gravity, you might not make some of those trips, little trip-ups that most people make when they see it for the first time. Okay.